So, one of our panelists is a little late. She'll probably show up, Sabrina Klein. But first, I'd like the other two panelists to introduce themselves. And you can just keep to the introductions, and then we'll get going on the topic.
Okay. My name is Gregory Wilson. I am an associate professor of English at St. John's University. I teach courses in fantasy fiction and creative writing, among others. My first novel came out, like Paul's, came out from Five Star 2 years ago, The Third Sign. Sequels to that and two other books are currently being shopped, knock on wood, by my agent. I also have a new podcast, which I'm co-hosting with Brad Bollier, also a member of the Writers' Symposium, which is called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, where we talk about various aspects of writing as it is related to the speculative fiction field, and interview a number of authors and editors and artists. Pat Rothfuss and Ed Greenwood is coming up, and Aliette de Bedard and Amal El Motar, and a whole bunch of other cool people. So you can check that out at speculatesf.com.
I'm Ramsey Lundar. I just got my PhD. I had to fight with my professor to move to the FinSop so I could make it to Gen Con this year.
Good man. Good man.
Have to keep the priorities straight.
Yep.
I write game products and right now short fiction. I'm a freelance author. I'll write whatever you pay me for. Do most of my work through Comstar Media. Also have a pretty good presence on RPGnow.com right now. These are my game products, also PDFs that I can't sell you. Short story anthologies I'm in with many of the other writers' symposiums. And I am so excited. These books got handed to me yesterday at noon. This is my first solo fiction book.
Good luck. Or good, I mean, good work.
If you know much about the writing field, good luck is probably more appropriate.
Well, thank you guys for coming. We're going to try to get you out 5 minutes before the hour. We're going to talk ourselves for a little while, and then toward the end, probably 20 minutes, we're going to do questions. If you have a really burning question, go ahead and raise your hand, and we will attempt to call on you. We like questions more than comment. Those are good. I am Paul Jeunesse. I'm the author of the Iron Dragon series. Book one, The Golden Cord, is out, and book two, Dragon Hunters, is out. And then I'm going to unveil, if you haven't seen it already, the cover for book three coming out later this year, The Secret Empire. So that's the new cover. I'm really excited
Your
about
covers,
it.
Paul, are always amazing.
Yeah, I got good covers. So I'm also the editor of the Crimson Pact anthology series. We've got the first volume out, the second one's coming out at the end of August, and the third next March. There's an open call for submissions for volume three. Volume two is pretty much done, but volume three, any of you out there who are writers and you want to write, go to thecrimsonpact.com and learn the submission guidelines, and you can send us a flash fiction story. So we actually look at everything.
What genre is that?
Crimson Pact encompasses urban fantasy, steampunk, horror, high fantasy. It does a lot. So it's a shared world without the shared world. If you want to know more about it, grab a Crimson Pact card on the table out there, read the back, go to the website, all that. Anyway, moving on to our topic. I've moderated and been on the World Building Geography panel, I'd say at least eight times over various cons. I'm a geography nerd, and I love it. I'm a little tired of giving the same panel, as you might imagine. Has anybody been to a World Building Geography panel that I've been on at Gen Con before? Okay, there's like a couple of you. Good, so everybody else is fresh, but we're still going to do something different. So instead, we're going to go over a lot of the basic stuff that you want to know. And if you've read the description, it says, a fantasy tale is made more believable when the world is set in, is well thought out, and has a measure of logic. Our world-building experts share their techniques for engineering countries and even entire planets that will make your story breathe. I like it. I may have written it. I don't know.
No, honestly, we don't know what we wrote.
Yeah, seriously.
But, it was good claiming.
Sure. So I'd like to just start out with a question to our two panelists and ask them, what is it about worlds in sci-fi and fantasy that makes you love the genre? Like, what is the most interesting thing about worlds for you guys?
I tend to imagine environments as characters, at least the most powerful environments. So when I consider And it's one of the reasons I love speculative fiction. It's because of all the literature that you can read, and I've read quite a bit, of all the literature that you can read, there's nothing that kind of can absorb you or transport you. I mean, escapism is not always a bad word, and even the escapist side of fantasy and science fiction involves transporting you to an entirely new universe. I think one of the great strengths, and they weren't all strengths, but one of the great strengths of James Cameron's Avatar is that it literally transports you to a world that, although those of us in the field had heard some things that were somewhat similar to this before, Cameron realizes it in a way that is extraordinarily powerful. And I do object to some of the kind of nitpicking where people are like, well, of course, I knew this when, you know, you can say whatever you like about it, but Cameron does a spectacular job in representing that world on screen. And there is that sense of awe, right, and palpable wonder that you get when you are first exposed to it. One of the things that I think is amazing about literature, because obviously the vistas in our mind are much more impressive than even the best 3D stuff you could see on a movie screen, is when you read a world that gives you that same sense of awe, right? When you have this sort of, you're reading along and you find yourself on, you know, the red plains of Mars in some near future world, or you find yourself in some kind of near future world, like, you know, reading Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and you find yourself in this world that is so different from what you know and yet has these sort of gateways into what you experience right now. So you can imagine a world like this, but you're still awe-inspired by it and struck by it. So I think of environments in that way as these kind of powerful characters, and that's what drew me to them. It's that, wow, I can't believe I just read that. That feeling I still get when I read the best speculative fiction, and it comes a lot from the worlds that we see.
Randy?
Since I think that's how a lot of us feel, can I answer in the reverse what destroys suspension of disbelief? What destroys the suspension of disbelief for me in fantasy and sci-fi is that people get the scale wrong. It's easiest to explain. I'll start from the sci-fi. You have the Star Trek syndrome, where a planet is a set and maybe a backdrop painting, maybe a landscape painting. And so you end up with these universes populated with planets that have populations in the thousands. And that's, you've got like one city per planet. And it's...
With one environment.
The
ice planet.
Yes.
What's that?
I don't have a lot of good things to say about it, but the Ewok movie, when they showed Ewoks tromping through deserts on Endor, that was good. It was released on TV. If you did not see it, don't worry. It's not on TV.
But it wasn't that good.
But that's the one good thing I can say about it, is that for once, Lucas included multiple environments on a planet. Fantasy has the opposite problem. People overexpand their worlds. A mile is how far a Roman legion could march in full armor in 1 hour. A wagon train moves approximately 10 miles per day. And you have these distances of hundreds and thousands of miles, and these characters going across continents and other continents. Don't overexpand your world. The Arthurian legends occur all in England. You don't need to, they don't even get over to Ireland. You don't have to have a large world. My two favorite examples, look at Southern California. You've got beaches, Death Valley, this giant sequoias, and mountains. Any Californians, have I left anything out?
You got it.
Okay.
yeah.
And since I live in Japan, go ahead and include that example too. All of the landmass in Japan is the size of California. And you've got oceans, you've got mountains, you've got forests. They're hilly, mountainous forests, but they're forests. You've got swamps. On the north side of Japan, you've got a small area that has the most beautiful white sand desert dunes you could ever want to see. And it's all in this very small island. So...
I'd like to just kind of let Ramsey keep going a little bit, because there is a phrase that you may have heard before, and it is, geography is destiny. Has anybody heard that one? No, not very many of you. Oh, a few of you. Okay. Well, it's so true. And geography affects so many things about a culture and a people. And Ramsey's going to tell us about his experience in Japan in a minute here.
The March experience?
Yeah, the March experience. You can unveil that in a moment. But I'd like to point out that geography is a bitch, okay? She's the see you next Tuesday word, all right? And a couple of you got it. All right, so she decided that all of the great rivers were going to flow, not all, many of the great rivers were going to flow along fault lines, tectonic lines, okay? Because the ground kind of goes under, so it's lower, so the water goes through that. So where do we build the cities? We build them along the rivers, right along the fault lines, and then we have problems, you know, like in Pakistan and other places. We have fault lines like on the edge of Japan, that the Pacific plate's going under Japan, and this causes some problems. So, Ramsey, why don't you just tell us about how geography is destiny when you were living in Sendai, Japan, where the nuclear power plant was when there was a little... What was that event? It was like a tsunami or something?
Okay. Yes, I just graduated from Tohoku University in Sendai, Japan, the closest major city to the epicenter of the quake. The thing about Japan is... basically, the earthquakes don't stop. There is a 90% chance Tokyo will have a major earthquake in the next 50 years. Sendai, I was there for 5 years, and they said that I did the math myself. In those 5 years, I had a 50% chance of seeing the next major quake. What we got in March was a once-in-a-thousand-year event. The first... and because of modern science, I can tell you this. The first reports that came in from the GPS was that during the March 11th quake, the island of Japan shifted 8 feet. Those were the first reports that came in. The second reports from the GPS that came in said, no, Japan didn't move 8 feet.
Sorry.
It stretched 16.
Stretched.
Do you
think it was a good decision for them to build that reactor right on the coast there? Think about that.
This is a once-in-a-thousand-year event. You cannot proof against something like this. This is hand-of-God stuff. The Japanese architecture, because they live with constant quakes, is amazing. The tsunami was very devastating. It took... The plant is actually in the prefecture south of us in Fukushima. Where we were in Sendai, we were lucky. We were away from the coast. We were up on a little bit of a... couldn't see the coast, nowhere near the damage. I did that intentionally. And the Japanese architecture is so good that... basically, no buildings fell down in that quake. Basically. The real damage was from the tsunami. And it came in and it just destroyed and people disappeared. And the worst is on a rise, you can call it a mountain, overlooking the coast. There was an elementary school and it was in an evacuation center, because it was up on this tall ridge. The tsunami came and the building's still there, but none of the people who were taking refuge were. Not fun.
Thanks for sharing that with us. Take a minute. Like, you got your attention, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so geography is destiny, and the decisions that, you know, your characters and people make affects them. The Japanese people have been affected by these kind of disasters since the island was populated. And it has affected their entire mindset. You don't want to screw up, you know, because if you do, your house is going to collapse and your children are going to be dead. You know, and they've known that for a long time. So I think that the Japanese people have been very affected, and their whole culture has gone in a certain direction because of what conditions they live under.
Yeah.
Can I say something on that?
Please do.
One of the things that My mom loves Gojira, mispronounced in English as Godzilla movies. My mom loves Gojira movies, but she always laughs at them because Gojira comes in, he smashes the city, and nobody takes it personally. No, I mean, you watch the movies, and when you live in Japan, and you have earthquakes, and you have tsunamis, and you have fires, they said Edo, the city of Edo was particularly bad for fires. They said that the life expectancy of a building in Edo was 20 years before it got burned down. And when you live with these natural disasters, the Japanese people have learned not to take it personally. It's an incredibly patient, enduring mindset because they keep getting knocked down and they pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and go on because that's what they have to do.
Yeah. I think it was an inspiring story to watch how the Japanese people reacted to that, yep. You know, that whole thing. Well, our other panelists, thank you so much, Ramsey. Yeah, we'll talk more about that. Our other panelist has managed to arrive. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, it's a long story, and my apologies.
Please introduce yourself briefly.
My name is Sabrina Klein. I have a degree in anthropology. I'm also studying for a degree in geographic information systems, which should be complete spring of this year. And I have a short story called The Shattering in Stalking the Wild Hare from the Symposium's publishing last year.
Yeah. Greg, do you have anything to say to add to what Ramsey said? Or?
Well, I was actually to what both of you guys just said. The thing about geography is destiny, I think, is interesting because what Ramsey suggested there is two things about people's interrelationship with geography and the place in which they live. The first is that geography obviously affects the people that they become. It affects their mindset. It affects their dialogue, their dialects, the things that they imagine for themselves. It gives them a sense of place. And that sense of place, and this is the second part of what struck me, is such that even when they are continually knocked down, they would, in many cases, prefer to remain because of the other things that that place gives them. And I think that's important. You hear this thing kind of thrown away by authors sometimes where they'll say, or people will say, well, why would anyone just want to live there, right? You know, well, why? I mean, if there's just earthquakes all the time, why don't they just move, right? You hear that sometimes, which is beyond the fact that it's incredibly ignorant. It's obnoxious. It's astonishingly ignorant about the reasons that people would stay in that same place, because for all that Japan was impacted by the tsunami, part of what made the Japanese who they are is their sense that they do stand up and dust themselves off and go to see the most beautiful white sand dunes that you would ever want to see. And I think one of the things that means for us as writers is we need to consider reasons both that geography affects the people that live there and why those people then take pride in these places, even if they are difficult to live, difficult spots in which to live. People on Earth live in extraordinarily difficult places, floodplains, deserts, right? Places that are very, in some cases, although I know Paul has some views about people who overestimate how dangerous deserts can be. But, I mean, the idea is that a lot of these places are extraordinarily inhospitable to human life from a certain point of view. But from another point of view, they provide a certain kind of, to be vague about it, I guess, backbone, right? They give people this sense of pride and place, and so it affects them in a way that's very positive. And that's something which you need to represent as well. Not just the reasons that, you know, how do I build a world in which people somehow survive, but how do I imagine the way that affects the characters in my story, and why would they want to stay in this world? And the answers that you get to that will be quite surprising. One way to do that is to do some study of anthropology, is to look at the ways in which people themselves describe the reasons that they wanted to stay in these places. And you will often be, first of all, humbled by those answers, and you'll also be able to then take that and apply it to your own writing and your own fiction. Because especially for what we do in speculative fiction, a lot of what we're doing is drawing from stuff that we know in the real world, right, and putting it into a fantasy or a science fiction setting. I know that one of the inspirations for your book was Mars, the stuff that you read about Mars, right? And so what we're doing in these cases is not just putting an overlay like, well, this is the steps of, you know, whatever in my book, but we're using those as inspiration for our work. Thus, it behooves us, I think, to know about all the different aspects of that inspiration, including why people go and why they stay in those places that are difficult in which to live.
Can I give two more examples about Japan, medieval Japan this time, and then I promise to shut up.
No, you're good. You're good. Okay. You have a pass. We gave Ramsey a pass. He gave whatever he wants this pass.
Okay. First of all, a question for you. You look at castles around the world, and the Japanese castles are made out of wood. Do you know why that is? Not really.
Isn't it heavily forested?
You're getting close. The reason Japanese castles are made out of wood is because they didn't have enough rocks. Japan is a resource-poor island. You show me one other country in the history of the world which has had a shortage of rocks.
New England could have given them some.
Yeah, and you look in the bases of Japanese castles where you have to use stones in the base, and you know those beautiful stone lanterns that you see in front of the temples? The daimyos would steal those and put those in the base. You find gravestones in the base. The most touching story is Himeji Castle, Japan's most beautiful castle. Mm-hmm. There is a millstone in there. Apparently an elderly woman had two millstones, and she donated one of them to the Lord so that he could build his castle. Mm-hmm. And everyone was so touched by this story that everybody started donating stones. And so these beautiful Japanese castles, these wooden castles, they wanted to build a milestone. They knew stone was stronger. They didn't have any stones. So that's one way that geography affects it. And as I was saying, with resource-poor island, they also have a shortage of metal. The reason why the katana is largely considered one of the finest blades in the world is because in Europe you had metal. If you break a sword, you ask your squire for another. In Japan, they had a shortage of metal. So you would take that same piece of metal, and you would work on it, and you would refold and refold, and you would refold it 1,000 times to make it as strong as you absolutely could. And these blades were family heirlooms. Actually, if you see a real katana, the metal blade is actually separate from the handle, because when the handle got worn out, they would take the handle off, stick a new handle on, and use wooden pins to hold it in place. I said two examples, one more. The reason why Japan has the wonderful nailless architecture, where they do everything with wooden blocks. Everyone? Thank you.
Well, Sabrina is our anthropology expert, and she's written a massive amount on world building, which you can find all of her essays at writerssymposium.blogspot.com.
Not all of them anymore, because you haven't been posting them.
I don't remember not posting anything.
I will email them you later.
Anyway, she's written a lot of great articles on world building, and a lot of it deals with geography, so go to writerssymposium.blogspot.com and just go back for a couple years. You'll find probably, 12, 15?
There's about one on each ecology.
Tundra, Arctic, desert, mountains.
Yeah.
So I'm sure you have lots to say right now, so go ahead and just get something out there.
Two things. They've actually kind of talked about the anthropology aspect of it a little bit, actually quite a bit, and they've gotten a lot really awesome information. One thing I want to touch on that I don't know if they, because I wasn't here, did you guys talk about maps themselves?
No.
Okay. Maps are extremely important, and I have about a 3-minute tirade on maps. This is a tirade. There are about 4 things you absolutely have to have on a map, and I realize everybody draws a map, and you draw a little road map to your house, and you know the streets, and then the local may know the streets, but as an author, if you take that map and you hand it to somebody else, they're not going to know which way's up unless you put some kind of directional arrow. It does not always, north does not always have to point up. That's something that's, leave that to cartographers. If you want the top of your map, your world is situated all the way in the west, you don't have to take your map and situate it all the way to the left. You can take it and turn it, put the west, make the west your focus. you want to put some kind of a scale on there, because if, say, I tell you to go down to the corner of Steak and Shake, and I tell you it'll take you from here, it'll take you about 15 minutes. Well, that's because you got to wind around and go down the stairs and around the corner, and you got to go down the street. But that doesn't tell you that it's, you know, maybe 1,000 feet from here. Okay, but you're sitting there thinking, okay, well, it's going to take me 15 minutes to walk. Wow, that's a ways. But you're not realizing the fact that it's only 1,000 feet from the building. So scale is important. A map that I really actually like to cite for scale is White Wolf's Exalted. Is anybody familiar with that? Okay. If you open up an Exalted book, you see this wonderful map. And I think it's like an inch equals like 800 miles.
Wow.
And on the map, the main island is about that big. The realm is huge. But without that sense, without that 1 inch equals about 800 miles, which I think is right, might be a little bit off, but it's huge. You wouldn't have no idea that it's gonna that your characters would take maybe a week or two to cross the island. So scale is extremely, extremely important. Another thing that's important is a legend or a key. You may know that a little symbol like this means a mountain, but somebody else, we all take that symbol for granted, may not. You may be using it to represent a temple, or a house, or a castle. So you need to put some kind of scale on your map, a key, an arrow pointing whatever direction, somewhere, some sense of orientation, especially to the sun. The last thing that you guys need on a map is a title. Because without a title, I could hand you a map of where I come from, which is the Cuyahoga Valley. And I could hand you that map, and you guys would see a river that goes windy, 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 windy in all four directions and flows actually north. Most people, without a north arrow and without a title, they would take the map, see where the river flows, and turn it around. Because all rivers flow south. In some rivers, that's not the case. There's about 3 or 4 major rivers in the world that actually flow from south to north.
The Nile
being the Nile.
Yeah, one of them being the Nile. There's another one in Europe. I can't remember which one. I can't remember which one it is. But there's about 3 or 4 of them. And without that north arrow and without that title, you guys would not necessarily know. If I gave you a map of the Nile and just the Nile, most people would take it and didn't tell you it was the Nile, didn't give you a north arrow. Most people would take it if whatever direction the water flowed, and they'd turn it upside down. Because the instant reaction is water flows from top to bottom. It doesn't flow from bottom to top. So you guys have got to have a title, a scale, a key, and some kind of directional point. It doesn't matter what direction it's pointing. Just let people know which direction the map goes.
All right, good, good. Okay, so I agree with pretty much everything she said except for the key. I don't think you have to have a key on the side that this equals temple, this equals mountain. If the artist is good enough, I think it's going to be okay. In some maps, yeah, maybe that's a good idea, especially some of the really detailed game maps that I've seen. I would have no idea that is a shrine, this is a temple, this is a monastery, this is a hot tub, whatever. You know, I wouldn't know. But anyway, that said, so this is kind of where I want to take this panel in a little bit different direction than it's been in other years. After mentioning a couple of key things, just read Guns, Germs, and Steel by Jared Diamond, all right? Just go and do it, and we're not going to hash that out. If you haven't read it, you've done a disservice. Just skim the like 8 farming chapters in the middle. Realize farming's important, because if you can't grow food, you don't have a great society, unless you have really awesome armies to steal the food from someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So quick things to keep in mind, and just if you just Google world building geography and maps, or world building geography and then my name, Paul Jeunesse, you're going to find all this information already posted on the internet on a blog. All right, so just you don't have to write this down frantically. Keep these things in mind. Stable agriculture, navigable rivers, these are question marks. Mountains, deserts, bodies of water, you know, that close off the area from other areas. Plants are easily domesticated? No. Yes. Animals that are easily domesticated? No. Yes. A mild or a harsh climate? Are there deadly diseases endemic to the area? Think the Amazon. Think Africa. Has the population been there for a long time, a short time? Are there natural resources? Do they have rocks?
It is not a trivial question.
What natural resources that are there benefit the local population? If you want to draw maps of your world and you're not a great artist, you can get things like Fractal Mapper, the campaign cartographer. You can get Auto Realm. You can hand draw it. Then you can scan it. You can paint it in paint programs. You can do all of these things. If you have crappy handwriting, I do not want to see any text on your map. Do I make myself clear? Good. When someone has shitty handwriting and they write the name of their world on the top and I can't even tell if it's an A or whatever the hell it is, I don't like it. Okay? So scan it into the computer and you have access to thousands of fonts and you can just type it on there. It's fantastic. Huh? You feel me? All right. So good. I don't want to go to those places that we just discussed. Oh, he does. Okay. You have a pass. Go ahead.
You were talking about with natural resources. Also consider the distribution of natural resources. I've never heard an explanation for this. If somebody knows, tell me. But basically, when you look at a map of the world, we're going to divide it in the Pacific here because that's what everybody does, and because it works in this example. When you look at a map of the world, basically, as you go further east, precious metals, gold, platinum, silver, become less common, and gemstones become more common. And a big source of trade, you have the stereotypical, India Rajas.
Yeah.
With the reason they have these huge gemstones. That's what the Europeans noticed, because the Indians have gemstones, but they don't have the precious metals. You go all the way to the other side, and you get to the Americas, and you have the great Incan gold mines. So, not just if there are natural resources, but the distribution will drive the trade and the cultural exchange in your world.
Yeah. Absolutely. If you want to make like a brief comment on what he just said or what I just said, then we're going to go to a different question.
Yeah, about the distribution, it will affect the trade. It will also affect what is sacred within a culture. You have cultures where wood, paper, etc. is very, very special. The Egyptians, there's not a lot of wood there. There's stone, there's mud, there's sand. But the only place you find wood, paper, etc. is papyrus.
Reeds, they have reeds.
Mm-hmm.
Swamp.
And common people did not really have these things. They did not have papyrus. They did not know how to read and write. That was a scribe's job. And the only people who had scribes were pharaohs and priests. So you can see real quick how the lack of a resource can affect an entire culture. Whereas you get somewhere up north where you get runes from the Teutonic peoples. And most people knew the runes. Then most people knew what they meant. They knew how to read them, and they would carve them in stone. The Celts in Britain would use trees, they would use wood because that was what was available to them. And they would carve on. It's a line writing, and they would use that to communicate. So you have different resources will affect how people use these things within their culture, what's sacred to their religion, what is common, what's commonplace to trade, what the merchants are going to get rich off of, things that rulers are going to regulate. And when colonial America, we didn't have sugar. There was sugar tax. So, you know, when they would send sugar, tea, whatnot over to this country, even 200 or 300 years ago, there was a huge tax because they could get away with it because we could not manufacture these things ourselves. So England was getting rich because of the stuff that we needed because we didn't have it. But at the same point, we had corn, which was something they didn't have. So
tobacco too.
Oh yeah. And that was a big one. We got real rich off that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, one of the things a lot of people don't know about corn is, does anybody know what teosinte is?
Let's not talk that much about farming, please. Okay. Jared Diamond's going to cover it, okay?
Yeah. But teosinte is what corn started off of about 1,000 years ago. Corn, as we know, it's only been around for about 1,000 years. So the Indians that were here took that natural resource and molded it to what they needed to. Mm-hmm. So natural resources are extremely important, especially with how they grow and what region they grow in. If you have a desert, plants are not going to readily grow. If you have a delta region, they're going to grow like crazy because the river is probably going to flood, taking all of the silt out over the floodplain, fertilizing all of that land, and you're going to have a lot of agriculture, which in turn is going to affect the religion, because then agriculture and harvest becomes extremely important to that culture because that's how they live.
The Nile, the Mississippi, the Mekong River, the Yellow River, think about that.
Amazon.
Greg, do you have any burning comments on
that? No, I want you to get on to your question.
Let's move on. All right, so we've all been places, and we've seen stuff, and it made an impression. Niagara Falls, yeah. I'd like the panelists and then the audience to think about a place that you've been that just was awe-inspiring, that impressed you. You're like, okay, in my game world or my novel or my story, I'm going to have something like this. I want you guys to think about that for a second. And the panelists, where have you been, or what movie have you seen? Avatar, whatever. What inspired you, and what did that inspiration cause after visiting that place or seeing that documentary about whatever?
I'm gonna
start with Greg.
I'll take that on first. I was affected by this place that I went in two ways. When I went to Greece, probably about 7-8 years ago, and I went to Athens, I had two experiences of this kind that you're talking about that were inspirational in the same way. The first was that I went to the Theater of Dionysus, which is on the side of the Acropolis. And I had done, at the time, I was doing some work, which ended up as my academic, partly in my first academic book, about theater, about the way in which theater operates physically and otherwise, about how those limitations affect the people that perform in them as well. And sitting on these ancient stone benches, which are sort of raked back on the hill, right? And one of the amazing things that you can still find if you go there is that they're not cordoned off. They're not held behind, ropes. You don't have guards waiting to keep you away from these things. The drawback of that is that it means that a lot of these things are falling into disrepair and over time are eroding and will eventually disappear, which is horrifically sad. But the one positive of it is that it means you can be right up close next to that history. And sitting in a place like that and staring down at what's left of the stage down below and imagining the sun beating down on my head, right? And imagining the sun beating down on the heads of the people who were watching Oedipus when it was performed for the first time, a play which I now teach 2,000 years later, was extraordinary. You know, you can feel the ghosts around you a little bit. And it ties in with the environmental side, because that same day, Athens had experienced a huge rainstorm, one of the biggest that they had had in years and years and years. It was pouring for a couple hours straight, which is very unusual for that time of year in Greece. And when I came out, after we sort of just ducked inside a restaurant to kind of wait it out, and when I came out, I remember very distinctly walking back up into the Acropolis and feeling like I had been slapped in the face by this air, this kind of dry air and the wind that was so dry after the humidity that I had just left, right? This rain and this pouring and everything else, and I felt like I had been smacked in the face, and it was a feeling that I will never forget and have represented since a couple of times, including in this book, because one of the things that struck me was that, and again, I know I've been sort of pushing this meme, but people are affected directly by it. They imagined this world as having a personality. I imagined this wind in a way as being like, wake up, you're in Greece, remember? You're in ancient Greece, remember? You can feel the ghosts around you, remember? And I think so many tourists, so many people go to these places and kind of walk around like, la, 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 la. You know, the joke in New York where I come from is that you can always tell the tourists is the people who do this, right? You know, because New Yorkers don't look at anyone, even on the subway. I mean, they're just like this, anywhere but look at the person directly. And tourists are the people who don't look down, they look up, all the time. And there's a kind of, there's a lack of grounding in that which bothers me. One thing that this told me was that I needed to be present in this environment and not just imagine the age, but imagine what it would be like to live in a world this dry, where wind was a constant, where all you ever knew was things eroding away and, you know, sand being swept away and beaches shifting several feet every couple of days, and how that would affect the way that people would imagine their environment. And so that has been something that I've always come back to and work on in my books. And part of it is simply being present in the environment to which you go and not being a tourist when you're there. For God's sake, just be there and feel it and imagine it before you start then making judgments about it and writing it in your work.
That was great. I had similar experiences when I was in Athens as well. Ramsey, places you've been?
Okay. The place that I think has affected me most is Osorizan in Japan. The translation is Mount Dread.
Nice.
No, literally, the direct translation is Mount Dread. It's at the very northmost tip of the Honshu Island. There's a little peninsula shaped like an axe handle, and it's the mountain on that if you want to look it up later and get the spelling. Somebody decided it was a good idea to build a Buddhist temple in the caldera of a semi-active volcano.
There's a lot of praying there, right?
Yeah.
A lot of Zen.
They think it is a piece of... The logic is that it is a piece of hell thrust up from inside the earth. And you take the bus up, and it comes up over the top, and you start down into the caldera, and there is just mist. I mean, you disappear from the earth. You go down into this mist, and you're going down into hell. You get out, and the slap in the face, the stench of sulfur in the air is about enough to knock you off your feet. Mm-hmm. You're walking along, and there's the center is a lake, and there are these streams of bubbling up out of the ground, these little streams coming up out of the ground. The water is literally boiling as it comes out of the ground. Yellow streaks everywhere from the sulfur residue. There are some places where it's steam coming out, and the Japanese will leave offerings, like the penny wishing well. They will leave small coins at places that they believe is sacred. The coins around these steam vents have been burned black from the acid steam coming out of these vents. And it's not a fun house. It's not, ooh, this is hell, look how scary it is. This is a place of death. This is a place of mourning. I forgot to mention the bubbling mud pits, another one. Yeah, I'm a gamer. I went in one side of hell and I came out the other. I thought it was a great adventure. It was so great, I later took my mother back. She was struck. She says she'll never forget that. She says, this is a piece of hell thrust up to earth. This is a place of mourning. This is a place of loss. This is not this world.
Fantastic. We're about to get to you. I'm sorry we didn't really do a lot of questions. Sabrina, quickly, you have some places? Or a place?
Actually, when I started making my world, there were two places that affected me, and they kind of got smooshed together. One of them would be the Ozark Mountains. There are these absolutely gorgeous, green, rolling hills that are just... In the morning, they're kind of misty. In the afternoon, in the summer, they are ungodly hot and humid. And at night, there is this very, very cool air that comes in, and it's just wonderful. I mean, there's no... I've not yet found anywhere to compare it to. When you look up at the sky, it literally looks like somebody took a can of glitter and went... And you can just see the whole Milky Way stretch straight through the sky. There's not a lot of ambient light down there. And when it is dark, it is dark. When the sun beats down, it is ungodly bright. And the other place is actually where I grew up. I grew up on the Cuyahoga River, and it is A lot of people think Ohio is flat. That part of Ohio is far from flat. If anybody tells you Northeast Ohio is flat, call them crazy. I really do believe that's where the phrase, I went to school uphill both ways, I really believe that's where it came from. I'm not kidding. But there are these areas where at home where you're going along and it's these fields and then all of a sudden the landscape just shoots up and there are these huge hills. And if you go up into these hills, you enter this area of just broken rock. And where there are these cliffs that are 50 feet high with all this moss and the sand, you can see where the rock's been broken and the sandstone is just all the different banded colors, black and browns and reds and whites. And it's all these little pot marks where the water's gotten at it. And all these rocks have shifted. It looks like a rock pile that the gods set down and said, okay, I'm going to scoop it out over here and I'm going to set it down over here, and they forgot about it.
Okay.
And that affected my world. That was really when I smushed those two places together, that was really where my world started. And it just, I can't get away from it. I mean, combining those two things of basically the two places I grew up in, because my grandmother lives in the Ozarks.
Okay. All right, good. We don't have a lot of time left. I'm sorry, I didn't really get the questions. We just kind of went off. Let's do a few questions right there. Young man, yeah. Question or tell us a cool place that you've been quickly.
Transition between like a desert and non-desert. So if you want to, you know, have a desert here and then, you know, farther south, southern hemisphere, you've got, you know, non-desert. But the only, I mean, you'd have to have some kind of like savanna-like terrain in between.
No.
Depends on elevation. Depends on elevation.
Paul's got to talk about deserts.
So I grew up in Nevada, Arizona, Utah. When you go from Flagstaff, Arizona, which you think desert immediately, no. Ponderosa Pine Tree Forest, 7,200 feet, and you drive down to Phoenix, it takes about 2.5 hours. You pass through, I think it's 4 or 5 different biomes. The elevation just goes down and down and down and down and down, and suddenly you're in this Sonoran Desert, you know, after passing through different kind of forest, and then more scrubland, and then serious desert. So it's about elevation. I grew up next to Death Valley, the lowest place in North America. My God, it's crazy. You can go from foresty, watery, beautiful to hell, you know, these salt flats at the bottom that are awful. So just keep in mind that elevation is a key thing. And in my world, in my Iron Dragon series, it's based on Olympus Mons, this volcano on Mars that's 65,000 feet tall, and it's 500 miles in diameter. So it's the same size as Arizona. So imagine a giant plateau, sheer sides, that's where the world is. People look off the edge, they just see clouds. When I was a little kid, I remember looking out the airplane window and seeing the clouds, and that inspired me, and I thought, wow, what if the characters in the world stood on the edge of the cliff and just looked down and saw clouds, and they don't know what's below? So that shaped their entire society.
And the impact on weather, too, on both of those sides. In Washington, where my wife is from, Washington State, you know, Seattle, everyone knows rain, overcast much of the time in Seattle, right? But if you go over to visit her relatives in eastern Washington and you go over the mountains, you end up with something which is much drier and more desert-like. And I think it also affects mindsets, too, because the people in Seattle do not think very much like the people in eastern Washington and vice versa. And so that can also change as well, weather-wise.
Perfect. That was a good question. Another over there?
I was just curious what you're having creatures affect the landscape. I'm thinking the sandworms and
doom. Oh. I heart you. I think that's great. If you can pull that off in anywhere near like Frank Herbert did, that is so super fantastic. You know, that would be an awesome thing that you could accomplish if you could come up with something quite like that. You know, and there's a lot of worlds where the creatures are kind of destroying the world, and other ones are sort of nourishing the world, and like Dark Sun comes to mind. a little bit. I think that's really cool stuff.
I'm sorry, very quickly. There's also two ways to play with that too. If you read James Patrick Kelly's Burn, it's a story which was which won the Hugo or the Nebula a couple years ago, in which there is a desert planet which is being forested, not deforested, but forested, because the people who want to live there are people who believe in a kind of Thoreau vision of Walden, right? They literally call it Walden. But the people who live in the desert, the creatures who live there, don't want forests. And so Burn refers to these people who burn down the forest because they don't want it there. We imagine the idea of clear-cutting as the problem. They imagine of growing the forest on their nice desert to be the problem in that case. So,
well, we're pretty much out of time. I'm sorry we didn't get to more questions. Some of the panelists will be available in the hallway afterward. We're going to do Gods and Magic after this. But real quickly, if you have to run off, run off. But final point, 15 seconds. Sabrina, 15 seconds, go.
If you guys are going to make a world, make it make sense. Like he was saying, if you have a desert and you put it next to the Arctic, I better see the Arctic up here and the desert down here and not the reverse, or you had best explain yourself.
Yeah.
Ecology has to make sense. Look at the planet. It's built a certain way. Go off what we know.
Good. Yeah. Ramsey?
Research, research, research. There's stuff in this world so weird, you cannot think it up.
Where can they come and get your books and stuff? You have any signings or anything like that? Or find you in the hallway?
Yeah, I'm shamelessly hawking. I'll be out in the hallway after this. I also have a signing today at, I think it's noon. Give me a second.
Greg?
Yeah, reading it. I have a reading at noon with Anton Strout, guest of honor. Also a signing later today in Authors Avenue, and I have books here as well. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, guys. You guys are great.
Tickets. Please bring tickets.